Oh, there was a couple of questions left over from before. Jim?
Yeah, I was thinking about that sensus fidelum, and it seems to me that that has little or nothing to do with what we're taught. And an example is, 90% of the Americans, at least, and I'm sure in Europe, believe that birth control is okay. And so the Pope cannot issue an infallible statement that birth control is morally wrong. So it isn't necessarily what we're taught from the pulpit or in catechism classes.
Mm-hmm. And in that instance, it wasn't just the sensus fidelium. The Pope, Paul VI, had appointed a commission to advise him about whether to continue having birth control be a sin or not. And they recommended that it be taken off the books and be thought of as responsible family planning and not sinful.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided on his own to disregard the commission and the sensus fidelium, made his statement. So see, that could not be an infallible teaching, even from the traditional point of view. John, you're going to add, do you have something to add on that?
Well, yeah. When Humanae Vitae was issued, of course, a number of theologians and priests issued statements saying, hey, it's wrong, it's not correct, etc. And immediately, people as a whole, from my perspective, I was still active as a priest for a few years thereafter, people just ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
The bishops and the priests on a whole shut up. Now, of course, Rome still makes it one of the criteria. But one thing was in Humanae Vitae that was very clear, and that was conscience. And the formation of conscience. And I, as a priest, in the confession, advised people, you have heard what the Pope has said, you know what is needed in your own marriage. You know the state of your marriage and whether this would work or not and would strengthen or weaken your marriage. I said, you have to form a conscience and make your own decisions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that's what exactly what people did.
This is a perfect example. And I put this quote on the board. This is from Milton, Paradise Lost. God and nature bid the same. Bid ask us to do the same. It can't be right if the religious authority contradicts healthy psychology and science. They have to go together if it's going to be real. So it's God and nature bid the same. So psychology and nature says responsible family planning makes sense on a planet like ours. So that's nature speaking. The voice of religion contradicts it. Does this make sense to you? Harriet?
Oh, I was thinking of the discussion going on before the break about the priest making the vow of fidelity, but the writing of Sandra Schneider's that I think is so terrific in that is that she makes it very clear that the women religious, or most women religious, don't make that vow to the church. They make it to God. And so they don't see themselves as being an army that the hierarchy can deploy out, because they see that they're really responsible to act and to go out and serve.
Mm-hmm.
Those that they feel called to
serve.
With discernment, I mean.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Mary?
I think I read maybe 3 or 4 years ago that the faculty at Catholic universities had to make a similar pledge of not teaching anything other than what's on the books.
Yeah. And in keeping with what John brought up, I also remember hearing confessions when I, during this era about birth control, when it was still such a big issue for people, and our church was in Connecticut. Anyway, I'm listening, I'm hearing confessions, and of course I had already said in the pulpit, you follow your own conscience. If it contradicts what the Pope said, your conscience is always primary, not the voice of the authority. So anyway, I'm sitting there hearing confessions, and I start to hear these women with a New York accent. You know, New York is the next state over. And they're, you know, confessing about birth control. And I, of course, I'm saying, well, if you, the same thing John said. You know, if you feel that this is important as part of your family plan, then whatever decision you make is fine. And I wondered, well, why are these people from New York here? And then later on, somebody told me that they heard about you. But later, I thought to myself, even that was not right. And the fact that they, you know, heard that there's some priests in Connecticut who give you that permission, even that was not right.
Mm-hmm.
Because you still didn't have the power to make your own decision.
Yeah.
You still had to get my okay on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the smallness that we're trying to get away from. So that, you know, you have the freedom of the children of God and free speech. Mm-hmm. Not only what you say, but the speech that you're hearing from your own conscience has to assume authority. He spoke as one having authority. Mm-hmm. What is that authority? One's own conscience.
Dave, how does a community, a faith community, get, Catholic faith community especially, get beyond that dependence on authority, which is so embedded in us? It's like, it's not in me personally, but I think it was at one time. It keeps us back from progress and from the church becoming what it needs to be for the world and for our local communities.
Yeah.
How do we get past that?
Well, like what we're doing right now, this is how we get past it. When we start to rethink and give ourselves the freedom that was always ours.
Most people don't have the time or the circumstance to do what we're doing either.
Yeah.
I'm not really asking it for an answer. I'm saying, what do we do?
Well, let's stay with that question as we go through this, because I think it's important. I was remembering something else, which was a little bit humorous.
Mm-hmm.
Once after Mass, after I had said Mass and I was standing in the back and people were leaving and saying, oh, what a nice sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. And this woman came up to me, a young woman, and she said to me, I just had a baby and I would like to be churched.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that word from the seminary and I thought, what the hell is this now? So I said, churched? Huh? So she said, yeah. You know, we go up to the altar and, you know, there's a ritual to it.
Right.
Of course, I had no idea what this ritual was. But I did remember in the seminary that there's such a thing as churching. I hope they still don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow before, after a woman had a child, before she could come back to church and Mass fully, she had to go through this little ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Called churching of women. And it goes back to the Old Testament. It's a Jewish custom.
Bring a couple of doves.
And it was carried over into our religion. So, you know, I wanted to accommodate her. She looked so sincere and serious. It was important to her. So I went back and I got the book. You know, and I'm looking up and I find churching. And, you know, so I did it.
Yeah.
I, worse than that, I was talking to a woman recently who was, for lack of a better word, a fallen away Catholic who had had a baby and wanted to have her baby baptized, and the priest refused to do it because they weren't members of that congregation. And, you know, if that was a rule that applied, she wasn't a member of any congregation. The baby can't get baptized? Give me a break.
Good point.
I think, you know, a lot of those laws, they stand in the way of love.
Jim said them, I'll baptize.
But you don't really have to be baptized anyway.
All right. So let's.
Shall I turn the recorder off?
I just wanted to remind us of Teilhard de Chardin. You're familiar with his approach. He's a Jesuit paleontologist who had this new, bigger view, presented a whole new cosmology. Cosmology is our view of the world. And he has something called the mass upon the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful thing that he wrote, where you offer not only that little host, but all humanity with all its joys and sufferings. And that too becomes consecrated. And he even says that. This is his quote, right from the hands that knead the dough to the hands that consecrate it, only one host is being formed. So everything that people do, and the Mass included, it's all one host. And this is one of his quotes, nothing can satisfy me unless it is on the scale of the universal. I can't be satisfied with anything limiting anymore. It has to be the all. And this quote by him is so beautiful. By virtue of the creation, and still more of the incarnation, nothing here below is profane for those who know how to see. So this anti-body approach that we were also brought up with is opposite of a true belief in the incarnation. Incarnation, in fact, that word means becoming flesh. And so when you're anti-body and have to distrust the body, it's the equivalent of anti-incarnation. So a phrase like this, there is no stain in thee, Immaculate Mary. Immaculate Mary, there is no stain. Immaculate in Latin means without stain. Immaculate Mary, there is no stain in thee. Now, what do they mean by stain? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They mean she never had sex. Mm-hmm. They don't mean she's, you know, physically dirty or not.
Wasn't Mary ever virgin?
It's Mary ever virgin. The first mention of Mary ever virgin isn't until the 4th century. But this idea of there is no stain in thee. See, we hear these words and we don't stop and think to ourselves, what? Why would they consider a sexual act a stain? Mm-hmm. But this is the patriarchal male view that made Mary small, where we lost the bigness of the Divine Mother. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, she's safely in her place when she's this, you know, most pure virgin. And most pure means no sex, as if there was something about sex that was wrong.
I thought it was original sin. O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee.
That's another part of it. but it also means that she's an ever virgin. John?
Augustine, beloved Augustine, considered the husband and wife could have only have relations for the purpose of conceiving a child.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But even then, it was at least a venial sin.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't quite right even then.
Right. And his answer to the question, well, when do you get the, how is the original sin given to you, is through the sex of your parents.
Mm-hmm.
Parents have sex, that's when you that's when you receive the original sin.
No wonder I'm mad.
So let's just take a look historically at this question about the body, the
dualism between the body as somehow evil and the soul as good.
Goes way back. St. Augustine himself was a Manichee. A Manichee is a follower of Manichaeus, who lived from 216 to 276. This is a spin-off from the negative side of Gnosticism, which taught that the world was created not by God, but by a demiurge, a kind of demon that created something evil. That's the world of nature, and now holds the soul captive. And that only if you had a special kind of knowledge, hence gnosis, which in Greek means knowledge, which could you find a way out of this. One of the followers of Gnosticism was this person, Manichaeus. He's a Persian Christian. And he was caught up in the idea of that there was a conflict between the light, forces of light, and the forces of dark. And the forces of light are those of the soul, and the forces of the dark are those of the body. And in his view, Satan stole light from God and hid it in the human mind. And through various teachers such as Christ and prophets, we can find a way to release this light, which is held captive in our minds. And he even taught that nature itself could be helpful to bring this light out. But that the only way this could happen is if you bring your body into submission through ascetic practices. And he even suggested vegetarianism as part of that. And that these truths are known only to the Illuminati, the enlightened people. It's a special occult knowledge that only a few have. So this teaching was condemned by the Church. But then it appears over and over again throughout the history of the Church. So it came back in the 12th century in France, in the times of the Cathars. They were also called the Albigensians. St. Dominic started his order to fight this particular heresy. They said that the flesh of a person and the material world are evil, and that this fleshly body was invented by Satan, and so salvation is to be released from your body. Mm-hmm. But now think about it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that something like what we were taught, that your mm-hmm. soul is going to be released from your body
mm-hmm.
at death, and that's the only way you're going to have salvation? They taught that Christ was an angel with a phantom body, didn't really have a body, because of course body is evil. Mm-hmm. He didn't really die and rise, but he only came here to teach us, and that he condemned, and this group condemned, marriage, sex, eating meat, eggs, or any animal products. And This heresy was also condemned by the official church. And it also goes back to another heresy called Docetism. Dokio in Greek means appear. This group taught, this is in the early church, that Christ only seemed to have a body. Mm-hmm. Didn't really have a body, because bodies are evil. Mm-hmm. And his sufferings were only apparent, not real. And Judas or Simon of Cyrene changed places with him just before the crucifixion. Uh-huh. They were the ones who were crucified. Mm-hmm. So this idea of the body is evil kept coming back. So, for instance, in the 17th century, now you have Bishop Cornelius Jansen. This is Jansenism. He's a French bishop. He says, we are inherently evil. We need grace to throughout our lives. That, of course, makes sense. But we have to use rigorous asceticism, beat ourselves, if we're ever going to find salvation. Still believed by the Opus Dei group. And this continued into the 18th century. A vast number of French bishops joined this, even though it was condemned by the Pope. And in 1723, the Dutch Jansenists in Utrecht started their own church called the Old Catholics. And that still exists today. So there's a long history of anti-body sentiments. And remember all the accents in the Middle Ages on the sufferings of Christ? Mm-hmm. And the Stations of the Cross and the accent on the Passion. All of that had the same flavor of the body has to be beaten into submission. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at this and we have to ask ourselves, was anything in my consciousness about my own body contaminated by the leftovers of these teachings that might have come through in the way we were taught from First Communion class through high school? Even though the official church condemned all this, at the same time it kept arising, and it just doesn't really, it didn't really ever go away fully. Yeah?
I have a question. Why does this keep coming up?
I think it has something to do with the tendency in us for self-loathing. Like, we just find it hard to believe that we really are okay. And so we will be attracted to teachings that confirm that. And that give us a way out. So these people had a way out. Don't eat meat, don't eat eggs, don't get married. Make sense, everybody? Jim?
And the whole reward and punishment thing reinforces that. Mm-hmm. From the time we're little kids, you know, we do something, quote, wrong, we get punished, and the message we get is that we're not wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, Dave, I've thought about the question that Tony has just brought up, because there is an element of asceticism which I think is healthy. But people get immoderate, or they use this as a way of imposing something on somebody else. So I think it's something in human nature that is always going to come up. And it's a matter of, you know, using your own discretion and wisdom and tolerance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good point. Regarding the overdoing it. And I have a friend who also left the priesthood, but he was a Capuchin, and he told me that when they went to the seminary, they were each given a whip.
Mm-hmm.
told to, you know, whip themselves at night before you go to bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you remember this, Keith?
Yeah. And it was a whole ceremony.
Yeah.
They all went to the room and they chanted the... And my friend said that his best way to solve this is he beat his pillow.
See, there's always somebody not following the rules.
Yeah, always. Even then.
Maybe St. Francis went off the deep end.
Yes.
Area.
Yes. That's a good point. Just before St. Francis died, the brothers at his deathbed asked him, do you have any regrets? He said, yes, I was too hard on Brother Ax, which means his own body.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Too hard on my body. I mean, our body is the instrument by which we are here to serve. So when we mess it up, we're messing up the only instrument we have to do this work. Mm-hmm. What is this work? To form a kingdom of justice, peace, and love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I would think that those sins that you mentioned back here that bring about the kingdom of justice and so on involve a lot of sins. Involve a lot of sacrifices.
Yes. Yes. That's the good sacrifice. Right. Yeah, she's saying to bring about this new kind of kingdom would take a lot of discipline and asceticism.
Wow.
Not beating your body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, putting yourself out there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe beating your body is the easier way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good point. Very good point.
Yeah.
Yes, I was watching that Academy Award documentary, The Most Dangerous Man Alive. It was about Daniel Ellsberg and, the Pentagon Papers. And there was a little moment in there that was so striking, really posed a question to me personally. He was being interviewed by somebody who said, "Don't you realize you might be going to jail?" And his answer was, "Well, don't you think it's worth it to go to jail to save lives?"
Mm.
And I thought, gee, would I have that kind of courage?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you mean by, that it would take discipline to make that kind of commitment. Yeah.
We have a love to punish others in our society. Our prison system is rampant. I mean, it's a complete economic system. It's got its own life.
Mm-hmm.
And we love... I talked to friends and this recent thing with the most recent incident at Times Square, and they felt this person should be beaten savagely and should be... It was like, oh my God, where are we coming from here?
Mm-hmm.
There's a tendency in us to want to punish others.
Mm-hmm. And punish ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's connected to this somehow, I think.
Yeah. That's something to feel sad about, that it's been like this, and the only reward is living well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only change you can make. So, any other questions on this part? All right, well, our time is about up, but next time we're going to go on into other features of this, and I really appreciate your attention. But before we end, I have a little poem to share by Walt Whitman, who wrote during Civil War times. But I just thought, after reading this, it'll be a great way to end, because it has a whole different way of looking at God than the way we were brought up with. Again, we're looking for the bigness, the bigger picture. Be not curious about God, for I, who am curious about each, am not curious about God. No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death. I hear and behold God in every object, yet understand God not in the least, nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment, In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, everyone signed with God's name. And I leave them where they are, for I know that wherever I go, others will punctually come forever and ever. And as to you, death, you bitter hug of mortality, it is idle for you to try to alarm me. Thank you.